We are in October, according to my calendar. It's a rainy month. So in spirit, the rainy season retreat has begun. It's really the whole month. And it is a month of focusing on the attainment of whatever is your goal in life. Do you even know your goal in life? Now, the official goal for satyogis, if they understand the teachings, is a term called jivan mukti. How many of you think you understand what that term means? Any of you? How many? Is there anyone who thinks you understand what jivan mukti actually means? I see. Whether you understand what it means or not, how many of you would like to achieve it so you will know what it means? Oh, okay. That's a very honest sangha we have. I'm appreciative of that understanding of the delusion that you are in, because of course you understand really what liberation is, but the role that one is playing may not allow you yet to admit to yourself that you do know. Now, the term means, in English, it's usually translated as liberation in life, while alive, while there is still a jiva, there is mukti. Now, how the Buddhists interpret this, which is not really different except in terminology from the Advaitins, is that nirvana is samsara and samsara is nirvana. Now, how can that be? First of all, let me ask you this. Does anyone think they know what samsara is? Does anyone think they know what nirvana is? Okay, I see the problem. Samsara is defined as the world as it is perceived through a body-identified consciousness. A body-identified consciousness of a human in particular who uses language and whose language includes an I thought, and that I thought, when it arises in the mental apparatus, attracts and fuses the consciousness with its definitions of itself, its definitions of the I as a being with a certain history, a certain attitude, a certain set of beliefs, a certain ongoing narrative, a certain way of projecting, a certain way of reacting, a certain way of thinking, and a certain habitual pattern of repetition of all of that. That's samsara. Nirvana is the same reality without the I thought and all of its accompanying beliefs and narratives. In other words, in nirvana, the I thought is gone. Because it was realized to be an illusion, because what the I signifies in reality is not the body or the mind or the beliefs or any of the paradigms and contexts projected by the ego. It's none of that. So the question is, can you live in a nirvanic state where you realize there is no I in the world of samsara, where the I thought is at least triggered by apparent events that occur to the body-mind? Is it possible to stay in the egoless state while engaged in activity? Which is why the core practice is here, especially, is karma yoga. Because it's relatively easy in a state of meditation, relatively easy, to stay in an egoless state for some period of time without narratives. Although for some it may not be so easy. But to have the body engage in activity of service to the community, to the world, to God, and still remain in non-duality and in egolessness. This is the question, how this paradox is to be lived out. So to me, the closest expression or description of the state of Jivan Mukti is contained in a classic text that I think we've read from before called the Ashtavakra Gita. Is that in our book list?
Yes, I asked you about
Okay, there are several translations. The most recent, not that recent, but relatively, is called The Heart of Awareness. We have that one in the list?
I think so.
Okay, well, add that one. There's also a translation and commentary by Ramesh Balsekar, a duet of one, and then there are several classic and bilingual editions. So, this is chapter 8. The mind desires this and grieves for that. It embraces one thing and spurns another. It feels now anger, now happiness. And in this way you are bound. But when the mind desires nothing and grieves for nothing, I'll add, and feels guilty for nothing, shame for nothing, fear for nothing, etc. When it is without joy or anger, and grasping nothing, turns nothing away, then you are free. When the mind is attracted to anything it senses, you are bound. When there is no attraction or repulsion, by the way, I'll add, you are free. Where there is no I, you are free. Where there is I, you are bound. Consider this. It is easy. Embrace nothing, turn nothing away. Okay? Very simple instruction for reaching that state of Jivan Mukti. But it's only an instruction about how to get to that point of freedom, not what it is, what's the benefit of it. Yes, you are bound to the I with all of its preconceptions, which you did not create, because as we know, the way that the I of the ego is formed is through projective identification. In other words, an original other, usually the mother and then the father, but it's the other of the family system, projects their fantasy of who you are to them. And the infant takes that in as if it is truth, and then lives out the demand of the other to be for them what they want you to be, as if it is one's own will. But free will has already been lost through the identification with the other's desire and demand of who you are and how you are to be with them and for them. So the I, that is why it is bondage, because it is an artificial, fabricated self that isn't who you are. Who you are is covered up from the moment that the ego forms. And once it forms, you can never know yourself. All you can know are the thoughts that come up that were initially installed into you as your operating system. And that operating system was embellished, I won't say upgraded, by first the demands of the mother, then of the father, and then of the whole system of the family, if there are siblings, and the relation and the designated position within the sibling hierarchy, and then within the school system and within the social system. But there's an indoctrination that is added on to that original system of self-alienation, in order to adapt to the further demands of one's life energy to serve those social orders rather than to discover who you are and what is your real essential goal in life that your heart calls you to. So the overcoming of the self-alienated I thought that first has to be recognized is not you, is a delusional form of selfhood. Until that has become ego dystonic. In other words, you realize, even at the ego level, that I don't want to be or think those thoughts and feel that way any longer. And an internal struggle happens. But the struggle can't be won at that level because the one struggling against it doesn't yet have power, doesn't yet have access to its real self. It is a struggle to not believe, and to not feel bad anymore the way that you were told you should, but in order to be free of the superego voice and its power to control you, that voice itself has to be silenced. And the question is, where does the power of silence come from? Because the narrative that goes on in the mind goes on whether you will it to or not. How many have discovered that? Okay. So your mental chatter is the other's mental chatter. It's not yours. It's not you. But you don't have the power to stop it. It is thinking you into the illusion of existence as a particular entity. You are not thinking it or those thoughts. So let me read another chapter 12. First I gave up action, then idle words, and lastly thought itself. Now I am here. Ridding the mind of distraction, single-pointed, I shut out sound and all the senses, and I am here. Meditation is needed only when the mind is distracted by false imagining. Knowing this, I am here. Without joy or sorrow, grasping nothing, spurning nothing, I am here. What do I care if I observe or neglect the four stages of life? In other words, the programming of classical India, from being the student to the householder to the vanprastha to the wandering sadhu. I don't need to follow those rules. Meditation, controlling the mind, these are mere distractions as well. Now I am here. Doing or not doing, both come from not knowing. But knowing this fully, I am here. Thinking of what is beyond thinking is still thinking. I gave up thinking, and I am here. Whoever fulfills this fulfills his own nature and is indeed fulfilled. So the question is, why would giving up thinking be fulfilling? You see, for the ego, giving up thinking would just create lack. It would seem to be a self-disempowerment, because the mind has been weaponized. It's a defense mechanism, an attack mechanism. It's a mechanism of control. It's a mechanism of manipulation of the environment, and of expressing the opinions of the internal other that you think are your own. But it is a force that has a particular use to establish a territory of power for the body-mind apparatus, in which it feels some sense of superiority and an ability to speak. So why would it want to give up the ability to think and everything that goes with that, and perhaps then not even have anything to say? And the only way that that question will be answered is once the experiment has been made of silencing the mind for a sufficient amount of time that you recognize that first there's a sense of relief, because most thoughts create some kind of suffering. Their thoughts of lack, of desire, of ignorance, of feeling like one doesn't get it, or like one needs to do more, to become more, to improve in this or that way. There's always a sense of striving for something, because one is not good enough, one is not yet secure enough, etc., etc. So the letting go of that narrative creates at least a momentary relief and peace. How many have that experience? Yeah? Okay. So there is then reason for the motivation to increase the amount of time that one feels that peace. But if one will take the experiment further and say, but then who am I who is feeling this peace? And if one doesn't seek the answer in words, because the words would come from the other and then suddenly there would be no peace again, but if one waits in the silence for the answer to come from the silence itself, then what one receives is not so much words, in fact, not at all words, but presence. Presence as a power. Presence as an intoxicating power. And the longer one stays in that, until one's attention is entirely absorbed into the power of presence, which comes with an energy of a quiet joy. It goes way beyond peace. It's an energy of light and lightness and freedom that opens the consciousness up to an entirely new dimension of its being that was not accessible so long as the chatter was going on. And then one recognizes, indeed, the ego is bondage. And one has the power now, the power that is coming from the real self, via the soul, if you wish, but a power that brings the ability to stabilize in the silence. And what was first perceived as emptiness and lack by refusing to think now turns into the fullness of that power that is without limit. And one opens with a sense of awe to the infinite nature of consciousness. The infinite nature that gives an immediate glimpse of what it will be like to be conscious once your body has died. You know, you hear many of these near-death experiencers talk about, well, suddenly my body was on the floor or on the operating table and it was dead, and I was, somewhere near the ceiling watching it, but no longer in the body, and I felt free and wonderful and joyous, right? That state is always present. When you are present as yourself, not necessarily on the ceiling, because the self is not really located anywhere, but we can say there must have still been a trace of ego that was a locatable point of presence. And then that point of presence ascends out of this dimension and ends up in a world of light. Although whatever trace of ego remains may cause it to bring into its creative imagination its ancestors or, pets who have died in the past or people or whatever and have an experience in some intermediary dimension until they are tapped on the shoulder by some spiritual guide and said, your body's not really dead and you're going back, you know. But what happens if you're not going back? When you're not going back? because it will happen, right? A time will come when you're not coming back into your body when it's over. Now what? What remains? And so if you are already liberated into that dimension of total freedom and awe, there won't be any fear, and there won't be any need to process remaining ego traces, whether they're of guilt or of anger or of fear or of whatever that would cause a bardo state dream-like realm to appear. If there were none of that internal projection still needing to be processed because you had completed all of your inner work while alive, then that freedom that you had attained would now reach its ultimate consummation. Without any sanskaras or predispositions to create or be subject to another I thought by entering the womb of another mother in a fetal body and receiving a new set of projections and a new set of instructions as to who you're supposed to be this time, without it having to go through that all again. And so if one is aware of the fact that you are now determining whether you will have to go through all of that again, or whether you're ready to graduate to the next level of consciousness, which is no longer finite consciousness, but infinite, are you ready for that? Are you done with what the ego level of consciousness can bring to you? Or is there more you want out of this level? Is there more suffering? Or have you not had enough? Empty promises of desire, have you not had enough? Have you not had enough of mirages and illusions? Would you not prefer the real? So once that is clear in your own consciousness, that yes, I want to be the real self, not the illusory fabrication, and not have the reality veiled from myself by my own predispositions to believe in a false narrative, and no longer have to suffer karma by being identified with a body that may be suffering, or a mind that may be mentally disturbed, but freedom from all of that, then that freedom must be gained now. Because only now is there the ability to know all of the levels of consciousness, from the densest, that is the ego level, to the level of soul in which the wisdom opens up and the love of God, of the real, of the whole of samsara, nirvana, and the superposition of the two can finally be understood, this ultimate paradox of a world in which there are fractal replicas, representations of the one whole being of the self, But would you rather not be a fractal sliver of that self and realize the whole of who you are? And it's when that clarity has been gained, not through believing it or having faith, but realizing it in the silence of presence, so that there is no doubt and there is no dependence on a book that says things like that. There's no dependence on a teacher or someone on the internet who says things like that. But everything has been learned and confirmed internally. Only then is there freedom. And so the way out has to be through an erasure of everything that has been written on your inner screen that determines what you perceive and how you behave and what choices you make. And there are many sages who say that, well, everything is predetermined, and no matter how you are harangued by any teacher, including this one, no matter what kind of persuasive concepts you are able to learn, it is always the will of God whether you will actually grok those concepts and see what they are pointing to and then know, are they true? Because do they point at what is real or do they point at another fantasy? And so it is only by the erasure of all beliefs and all disbeliefs that the real can be known without doubt. And although we say it is God's will, which is accurate, but is there a difference between you and God, or is that difference created only by the fabricated narrative that causes the belief in that difference that then perceives what it believes? And once the beliefs are gone, what happens to the perception? Because every perception is an interpretation of reality. You don't see what is, you see your interpretation of the data, but you don't see it as it actually is. You don't see even where the information comes from. You don't see that you are projecting the world, not that you are perceiving it. The world is not outside your consciousness. You are interpreting it as if it is outside, but it is what you are. Consciousness is what you are. The world is within you, not outside you. You are it. And that capacity to perceive and interpret, what happens when it no longer interprets samsara or nirvana, but simply perceives what is without interpretation, and thus perceives only that which is inconceivable, because no concept can prevail. And once this has been retrieved from having forgotten that this is in fact your natural state, then that inconceivable state that some would refer to as awe, as wonder, as astonishment, as self-mastery, as realization, as God, whatever, all of those terms they fail to capture the truth of what is. But what is so overwhelmingly beautiful that the mind would never return from that to a thought construct of what the world is. It pales. It's like living in a dollhouse rather than in the real, to use an Ibsenian phrase, but it is no longer even possible to fit in that dollhouse of the ego. And because it's the natural state, and no one is there, because there's no I thought that travels to that state, it's the end of I thought. It's the end of both I and other, because both are concepts. So, as Gaudapada stated it, he's kind of the forefather of Advaita Vedanta. There's no one liberated. There's no one in bondage. There's no world. No one was ever born, no one dies. All of this was just a dream in the imagination of a dream figure who never was. And that's Jivan Mukti. Now, whether that helps or not, perhaps it's at least some kind of food for contemplation of the fact that it's worth contemplating. And all of the symptoms that distract you, whether they're bodily symptoms of suffering, or they're attitudinal symptoms, or they are behavioral habits that can't be let go, or it's an inability to sleep, or an inability to wake up, or an inability to have energy, or an inability not to be manic, or it's an inability not to be bipolar, or whatever is the pattern that the ego is stuck in. As soon as there is that realization of presence, that pattern no longer belongs to you, and it is easily deactivated. But not by struggling against it, but simply realizing you have no longer any relationship to it. And once it no longer serves you, because it's the functions are always there to hold on to some trace of a past trauma or a past situation in which one felt loved, or one felt secure, or one felt like one was oriented properly to reality, or one felt devastated and destroyed. Regardless, it is the holding on to some past event either in order to have an alarm system that says, never again, don't go near that, or that's all I want, I have to have it again. Either way, and usually both of these sorts of phenomena of carrot and stick are present, once they no longer have any attraction, have any relevance to your presence, they fall away. They're simply obsolete fictions of a book you're no longer reading. But as long as you're glued to that script, to that text, then even when there are moments of opening, they'll be followed by a, but I don't really get it, or I'm not really free, or my mind can't really understand why I just felt so good for a moment, or whatever, but the mind closes in on itself again. The ego takes over, and those moments of your natural state suddenly appearing, either serendipitously or as a result of some meditative practice or whatever, there is a constant sense of wanting it again, but knowing that it can't last. And it's that that produces the hopelessness, the belief that not yet, it's in the future, and the future never comes. So you can't strive for liberation. You either are liberated now and always have been, or you never will be, because the future is an illusion. So it is only in the state where you are effortless and narrativeless, without mental chatter, without identity, in those moments of freedom from your ego, that there is the opening to establish yourself there. Because the ego has no power to claim you back except your own loyalty to it. This is why, you know, the main issue in prisons that prison psychologists talk about is recidivism. The prisoner, once they're released, will commit another crime, usually right in front of a cop, get rearrested and brought back to the cell, because the prison has now become their comfort zone. They no longer want the great escape. They want the security of that sense of control over that little environment. And that sense of, I know at least how to manage things here, but out there in the infinite, there's nothing to hold on to. It's that willingness to let go completely and not hold on even to an I thought that alone brings freedom. Okay, there's more I could read from the book, but I think it basically has already expressed its essence in those lines. So the floor is open if anyone has any response or question or comment about it.
Thank you, Shunya. You mentioned the intoxicating power of presence.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak more about that?
Well, yes. You know, all the Sufi sages talk about that. They're drunk, right? Because that power of presence comes with an inherent adoration, a joy that is love of the infinite presence and the joy of freedom. It's intoxicating. You know, like divers talk about rapture of the deep, you know, and they go so deep into the ocean, they don't want to come back up. And it's that same rapture. Well, I don't know if it's the same rapture, but it's a rapture of being absorbed into the infinite and no longer existing except as that. There's no more sense of a self in something, but it's just what is, and what is just, there's no word for it. It's awe, it's love, it's joy, it's bliss. None of these words express what it is, but the ecstasy of it is such that those who know it want to stay in it forever. Don't want to come back into the ego. And so once it's tasted fully and you're drunk on it, you don't want to stop drinking that nectar. It's life itself. And so the addiction to liberation takes over, and there couldn't be any will to leave it behind. It is all that is real. It's the essence of beauty and goodness and joy and fullness. And in that state, one's charitra, one's role in the phenomenal drama is complete. One can die happy in that state. You know, one has already died to the ego, but there's no more drive to come back because I got to do something. You know, I got to prove myself, or I've got to turn this into a poem or into a novel or into, you know, some work of art. I've got to tell people. There's no one to tell. There's nothing left. It's over, you know. So the great sages don't tend to, when they've reached that level of producing art any longer, although, you know, they produce scriptures and they will produce sometimes haiku or sometimes some trace of that joy in a poetic teaching. But it is usually only in response to a question. But there is a complete satisfaction in the stillness and no impulse anymore to do anything or sense of being an agent who does. Everything, if it does happen, it flows from that source. There's no intermediary who thinks I deserve credit or blame for this production, this song, this work of art, this whatever. Whatever happens flows from that source itself. Okay, so I hope that helps in some way. But it's perfection. Nothing could be improved upon. Mm-hmm. Nectar drop.
Thank you. I feel this teaching has really been helpful for something that I've been contemplating lately, and these thoughts and not being in a silent space. And I feel, I know you just spent the whole evening talking about how to silence the mind and get to the presence. But when these thoughts emerge that take me out of the presence of like guilt, or it produces some anxiety within the body,
mm-hmm.
but how to separate myself to know. I mean, I feel like that it takes over in a way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the first thing is you have to become a very discerning observer. And you have to recognize that the thoughts that came up that either say you are guilty because you didn't do this or that, those are not your thoughts. They're an internalized superego that was originally some other that you identified with and accepted their judgment of you, and now that has become a self-judgment, right? In the sense of these are thoughts that are occurring in your mind. But as soon as you discern the fact that they're not your thoughts, they are an internal other, they are like a mind parasite that's feeding off of you. Those thoughts feed off of your life energy the moment you believe they are your thoughts. And that's when they create anxiety, because your life energy is being drained by this apparatus that now is feeding off of your consciousness and has taken over your consciousness and is impersonating you. And you have bought into it. You have to realize you are not those thoughts. So the first step is fission. Before there can be fusion with the real, there has to be fission from the unreal. And the thoughts, whatever they are, the narratives, either if they're positive or negative, they are just lures to grab you back into the belief that those thoughts are yours. When you realize it's not, then you can delete that program. You can't delete that program if you think it's your own thoughts. You have no power over it, right? But as soon as you realize, no, these are not. These were installed into my consciousness by external others who literally possessed you when you were a helpless baby and were as if they were gods. You had to take in what they said. You were totally dependent on them. And that dependency got internalized into a dependency on those thoughts to know who you are. But they are not who you are. They are, in fact, who someone else wants you to be for them, and that other wants to control you through making you feel anxious and less and worthless. So they can feel superior and you will do what they say. So that relationship to your thoughts must be recognized as an internal attack upon you, a usurpation of your consciousness. And until you become sovereign in your own mind by deleting those thoughts, you can never be free of that bondage, right? So that's where liberation comes in, is freedom from your own thoughts, not from some external other anymore. It's always only your own thoughts that cause you to be enslaved, right? But they're not yours. So the ability to watch the thoughts, to see them as mental objects, and to recognize that just because a thought says you should feel guilty because you didn't do X, Y, or Z doesn't mean you have to believe it. Okay? So the first step is disbelief in your own thoughts. Now that's very hard for an ego. It's easy to disbelieve anybody else's thoughts. But to disbelieve your own thoughts, that is the step that brings freedom. Okay? To realize that your thoughts are delusional and they are the cause of your suffering and you don't need them anymore. You did need them as a baby or even as a child. Mommy says, don't cross the road without holding my hand, you know. Then if you still believe that as an adult, you're not going to get very far in life, you know. So there are a lot of roads you want to cross without holding someone's hand. Well, having those thoughts in your mind is like somebody's holding your hand and telling you how to feel, and you should feel bad for this and you can feel good for that. Right? They're giving you the rules of how you should feel. You don't need to live by those rules anymore. They have no validity. Don't give them jurisdiction over your mind. So you free yourself from that. And then you say, who am I then? If I am not that, what am I? And then the spiritual process begins. Then you're in Atma Vichara, and the power of presence will come and fill you. Okay? Okay.
Thank you for tonight. I have a question. It's not very well thought out, but I was kind of thinking more about it when you're answering to Amrita, and you use both recognize and realize. And I've started reading this book you said, The Doctrine of Vibration, and it goes really into a lot of the history of the Advaita Vedanta and the Kashmir Shaivism, but they're talking also about the doctrine of recognition, and I don't quite understand it all, but I guess I'm kind of like wanting to ask this question of what is recognizing something versus realizing.
Recognizing is on a symbolic level because it's cognizing, but it's cognizing again. It's remembering that you already knew this, but now you're knowing it symbolically. You're knowing it as a concept, but you once knew it for real, and that's how the concept got created. So the recognition will lead you to realization. What is it that I am cognizing, right? Because as long as it's still a thought, there is not yet realization. But it is the stepping stone to realization. Without recognition, there can't be realization. If I don't recognize what it means to be liberated, then I won't be able to establish myself in that state. I'll just say it was a hallucination or a strange moment, you know, or a synchronicity, or I'll label it as something and then it's gone and I'm back in ordinary ego consciousness, right? But if I recognize, no, this is a portal to the real, and then I stop all further narratives because now I'm done. I've recognized the self. I don't need to think about it anymore. The thought has found its target, right? The arrow has hit the bullseye. Once that's done, there's nothing more to do. You're finished with that phase of the work. Now it's just being. No more thinking.
Thank you. That was helpful. Okay.
Yes, hello. I have a question about silence also. Because you speak a lot about silencing the mind. And I've been contemplating what that actually means, which would also mean that I don't know if I have silenced my mind. I don't know what a silent mind is. I wouldn't know how to recognize if
there
my mind
has... There would be no one
to
have that question. Silence of the mind means there's no one left to doubt whether you know it or don't know it.
Right.
Because you neither know it nor don't know it. You are it. So knowledge is gone. That's why there's no more recognition. Cognition itself is over. That's what silence means. There is no further cognition. Cognition is a very low level of consciousness. You're just a cog in the wheel. But when you have ignition and you are light, then cognition is obsolete. And there's no doubt, because in that state of silence, the self is revealed, and the self has no doubt about its true nature, its bliss. There's no one left to wonder and doubt. That's the state where there is no silence, is that doubt. When there's no further I thought to have a doubt of whether I'm silent or not, because there's no I to be silent or not silent, then that's real silence.
So basically, when it happens, or when the mind is silenced, I just know. There's no doubt.
You are the silence.
There's no doubt.
That's what you are. But the silence is pure intelligence. It's not like I'm in a trance. I'm like asleep or in a blob. I was hit on the head and I'm in a concussion or something. No. It's total aliveness of the infinite self that knows it never was the body and never had to use language to understand reality. It's completely free. There's no doubter left. And the mind that is having this question, that whole mind is gone because it's a very low level of mind. You're in a much larger infinite mind now. You're in the mind of God, not in the mind of the ego. That mind has no doubt about its true essential being, right?
Thank you.
So is there any relation? Like, I feel like with the hand-holding, like that kind of connected, like the hand-holding of spiritual practice itself. Like if like a moment of grace comes, but then you feel like you're kind of failing recently, you know.
Well, that narrative is false. That's your ego trying to grab you back. There's no such thing as failure.
Yeah.
That's a silly concept.
So you can, like, there's no relation to what the phenomenal body is doing. Like if the realization is there, that can be the portal to the real.
Yeah, that's right.
If you don't buy in.
There's no you to buy in any longer. That's what you get rid of, is that I thought that that wants to buy into something. It wants to have a belief to hold on to. And it wants to identify with the body and to know, did I do good or did I do bad? Or, you know, wants to measure itself. The self is immeasurable. And so it has no need to conceive of some a place where it is on some conceptual thermometer of am I at this assemblage point or this. All of that is no longer necessary. Those were like training wheels, you know, but you don't need them once you can ride the bike and it's over. So there will be no longer anyone to think those thoughts. But everything will happen spontaneously as it should, without a glitch, because you're not getting in your own way. And the intelligence of the real self will now function directly to propel the body to do what it's here to do, to complete its karma. But it has nothing to do with you. You see? And this is what was meant in the Bible when it said that it was when Adam and Eve ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's duality. And am I doing good or am I doing evil? And, you know, all of this, suddenly you're in a judgmental mind. And it's freedom from that judgment and no longer eating from that tree. That's what liberation is. Then you're eating only from the tree of life. And life is beautiful and without any duality to it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hello. I have a question. I hope it's related to what we're talking about. I feel like it is. And actually, in response to Jake, you just mentioned karma will still, I don't know what exactly you said, but the body will still live out its karma or need to go through its karma. And that was kind of related to my question, because I feel like what you're teaching always, and especially tonight, very simply actually, is the only job we have to do is reach that presence in life. And then the question that came was, what is the job then of, like, we came into this particular life that we actually chose in these particular set of circumstances, from what I understand, to live out some, because of sanskaras, like there was also a purpose of why we chose this particular circumstance.
Yeah, of course there's a purpose, but it's God's purpose. Do you know that purpose? You won't know that purpose until you reach God consciousness. Then you'll know. And then you'll be able to fulfill the reason why you were alive in that particular form. And you will receive a new script, not the sanskara script from the past, but now you'll receive the script from God that is giving you the truth about who you are in the present, you see. And now who you are will be divinized. It will no longer be the human level. You will have outgrown that level through the practice and the maturation of your consciousness that is gained through all of the inner work that you do to recognize first and then realize that you are not the ego. You were never born, but this body is yours to now come into it as an avatar, as a divine being, to express the presence of God in the world through beauty, through grace, through all of the virtues and all of the signatures of God's presence through you, through especially the divine feminine aspect of God, and to bring all of that beauty and love and truth and joy into the world, no longer as a human ego suffering karma, but as one who has come into the world without karma, without a past, who comes directly from the light and brings the message of the light to the darkened world and brings that light in such a way that others cannot but perceive it and be in awe of it, but without any care or interest in how it is received, because you are simply living out the perfection of the will of God, and there is nothing else that is real.
That's quite the answer. Thank you.
We've got a few minutes left, if there are any. Okay. There's one. Was there anyone on Zoom with a question? Bruce? No?
No question.
So I have a question about faith. You mentioned it's not about belief or faith, but realization. And it's the will of God that determines what is grokked. Last night I was listening to teachings of St. John of the Cross, which I never thought in my life I would go back to. So that was a moment. But he mentioned there's a limit to our intellect, and there comes a moment where it's actually faith that's the connection to God. And you teach a lot about like the development of our intelligence as in growing into God. I wonder if what he's speaking about is more the adoration level, like what he's calling faith is adoration, mm-hmm. in the way that you would teach it. I'm just trying to understand the difference between it's not belief or faith, and then faith actually being the portal into the mystery.
I think what he's talking about is faithfulness. Okay, so it is faithfulness to your beloved. So you return to your beloved instead of being wandering around and abandoning your lover. You're back home, and you return into that oneness. So it's not a matter of the intellect, because it's not thought anymore. Your past concepts. But the faith is simply the opening of the heart. And indeed, it's at first adoration, but it's not dualistic, because the concept of separation from God is also gone. The faith is the faith that you and God are one. That's the Christian teaching. What is true for Christ is true for all of us. I and the Father are one. Okay? So that's the real faith.
In a way, would you say the consistency and the remembrance to remain faithful is a form of intelligence? Or do you get into intelligence and wisdom and these different kinds of... would you say that's intelligence, to be able to hold that consistency?
Well, once it's realized, then it is God's intelligence that is now your intelligence. There's no longer any separation. There's no longer someone who is intelligent enough to hold on to that faith. you have already transcended and been absorbed into the one you adore. Mm-hmm. So there is no difference. And once there is no difference between I and the Father, because I is the Father, there is only one I, there is no other, mm-hmm. then there's no one to fall back into illusion.
So that faithfulness is in a way faithfulness to the intoxication. Like
yeah,
there's that kind of magnetic kind of pull to that you want to stay loyal to.
Yes, and to the one who's intoxicating you with their beauty and their infinite awesome being, right? Mm.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I find very... You've posed several questions through the teaching, which I found really interesting and worthwhile to ponder. Mm. Just contemplate that question and see what comes from it. But there's one in particular that I can't wait. I have to ask you because I got really mind-boggled by this one. And you said, can you perceive the world without interpretations? Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of imagining just a regular day, right, where, oh, the sun is so beautiful, but there's already an interpretation, right? Mm-hmm. And then, oh, this fruit is delicious, there's, and then it could go on and on and on, right? Or mm-hmm. this person has this energy, this situation has this charge or whatever. It's constant. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's horrible. Because if what we have to do is perceive the world without any interpretation, I find it's much easier to let go or at least to accept letting go of interpretations that are negative. But when they're beautiful interpretations that produce joy, or at least that's the feeling or the maybe the thought that is associated with that feeling, and I might be wrong, then one doesn't want to let go of those interpretations.
But actually, doesn't the feeling come first, and then the interpretation, right, of it? Mm-hmm. But first there is simply the rapture, whether it's of a taste or of a vision or of whatever is occurring mm-hmm. In the awareness. It's ecstatic, it's blissful, it's awesome, right? Mm-hmm. And that state is constant no matter what it is that is appearing. That's who you are. And then whatever appears, you label it as if, oh, that thing caused me to feel this. And then you want to eat more of that fruit or see the sun more or whatever, right? But it's not that thing. So your interpretation is that caused me to feel joy. Or that person caused me to feel good or bad or whatever. Mm-hmm. No, those are all coming from within. And once there is no more interpretation, then those things no longer arise, actually, even as feeling states. There is only the ecstasy of presence. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what appears or what disappears. The ecstasy is what is constant.
Yes, I understand what you say, but suddenly then the thought comes like, how can you be in ecstasy when the interpretation is negative? It's just because you're interpreting it as negative, but it doesn't have to be that way. It just is.
That's right. So it's a habit to interpret. Uh-huh. And once you recognize that habit is actually what takes you away from the ecstasy of presence, uh-huh. then the habit falls away. Because you don't want to interrupt the joy of presence, right? Mm-hmm. So now here's the real test, however, because samsara is nirvana and nirvana is samsara, your body-mind apparatus has service to do that requires interpretations. Mm-hmm. Right? I have to prioritize things. Mm-hmm. I have to decide if we have the budget to do this or we don't, right? There are many things that will require an interpretation at the phenomenal plane level, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be able to be aware that this is the job that the body-mind is functioning as part of its service, but not be identified with it. And then the interpretations will come from that higher intelligence, and they'll be without bias, without projection, without prejudice, in a very neutral state. But the bliss of one's presence will not be gone. And then the body-mind will make the decisions that are necessary without any, extra time considering should I or shouldn't I, and is it, none of that, those doubts will be gone. There will, everything will simply be done very rapidly and effectively because there'll be no ego involvement in it, right? Or if you're in the kitchen cooking, you won't be so concerned with will they like this recipe and should I add more salt or less or this or that. Everything will just flow from an internal knowledge of what is accurate spontaneously. The Tao will work through you. And even if there is some kind of an error, there will be a correction and that will happen. It was the will of God for that to happen, and then there is a deeper level of discernment and development of capacities. So there is learning through course correction, but there's no identification with any of that. And then the moment that that work is done, then there's just the bliss of presence again. But it was never lost, you see, no matter what. And it's when you are used to being in that state, regardless of if the body and mind are working, playing, asleep and dreaming, or in deep sleep, that ecstasy of presence never changes, never leaves. That's turiya. Mm-hmm. Right?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so let's see. Yeah, this is, unless there's a last burning question from anyone, then we will adjourn. Was this helpful this evening?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. Well, if it is, then you will know that you're already liberated and there's no reason to strive for it. And realize that the goal of liberation is the final obstacle. Okay? So you mustn't have an aspiration toward that state of freedom as if you are not in it already. That's the delusion and the loyalty of the ego to the superego internalized voice and illusory power that one is subjected to so long as one is in the grip of ego narratives. Once the mind is silenced and there's no doubt about what silence is and that silence is your true nature, you were never in bondage. You will realize that, and there is nothing to be liberated from or ever was, because all there ever was your own consciousness, nothing else. There's nothing outside or beyond that. That's all that is. But know the wholeness of your consciousness, not simply a surface level of it. Know the infinite depth and the infinite dimensionality of the creative genius that is the God Self, and let that pour through without obstruction, then life will be immensely fulfilling. Namaste.
Namaste.